The Investment Trust Show, brought to you by Henderson Global Investors, managing investment trusts since 1934.
Time now for our regular weekly program, The Investment Trust Show, brought to you in association with Henderson Global Investors. Each week we explore the main features, factors and developments affecting investment trusts. And this week we're going to look at how to pick an investment trust. To do that, I'm joined in the studio by Nick Britton, Head of Training at the Association of Investment Companies, otherwise known as the AIC, and John Newlands, Head of Investment Companies Research at Brewin Dolphin. And my name's Ed Bauscher. So good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. So just as a recap, let's start at the beginning for any listeners who've never tuned into this show before. Why don't we start with you, Nick? What is an investment trust?
Well, an investment trust is a fund. It's a diversified portfolio. So rather than picking a bunch of shares yourself, you hold a fund and the fund manager selects shares for you. Now, it doesn't need to be shares. It could be property. It could be other kinds of assets. But let's say it shares. Now, the special thing about this kind of fund, an investment trust, is that it's traded on the stock exchange. So whereas with a conventional open-ended fund, the manager will create and cancel units in the fund when you buy and sell. With an investment trust, that doesn't happen. There's a fixed number of shares in the fund, and you access the fund by buying shares in it on the stock exchange.
And John, are they appropriate for everyone? Should all our listeners rush out and buy an investment trust now?
Well, Ed, I speak from a position of total bias. I think this is this is a club that if you join it, you will never regret it. You will stay in it for life.
But it's fair to say, I guess, not everyone should consider investing in the stock market. It's not appropriate for everybody. But if you've got to that stage, then maybe you should think about investment trusts.
Exactly. These are shares. Obviously, you carry the risk that implies. And you have to be extremely careful when you're selecting them. And they're not for everybody. But if you are in that, frame of mind, then they are the best and, in my opinion, the only place to start.
So why don't we look at a couple of sort of examples of people who might be considering investing in investment trusts? Shall we start with, say, someone in their 30s who's perhaps on a reasonably good salary and is trying to save for their retirement and they're thinking about investing in investment trusts? But what should they be looking for, Nick? Should they be very much focusing on trusts that deliver a rising share price and taking on a fair bit of risk? Or what should they be thinking about?
Well, that investor you've just described, so a 30-something saving for retirement, is almost a sort of perfect investor for an investment trust, really, because they have a long time horizon, several decades till they're going to retire. I don't know, when I'm going to retire. I'm in my 30s. I don't know when it's going to happen. Probably never. But you have a long time horizon. You actually have the ability to weather the volatility of the stock market. And that matters less to you than your overall return over time. So to answer your question, yes, you could focus on investment trusts that have a growth-oriented strategy. So that might be investment trusts that focus on, for example, smaller companies or emerging markets, for example. Or you could actually go for investment trusts that have an income strategy and simply reinvest the dividends. And if you look at a lot of research, it shows that actually investing in income-generating equities and reinvesting dividends is a really great way to get a good total returns over time.
Is it also worth thinking about the kind of personality that you have, John, to sort of... Are you the kind of person who can make this investment and not worry about it too much for 30 years, or are you going to be fretting and worrying all along the way?
There are ways of approaching this, and I guess if you were new to the sector and you didn't want to pile in too quickly, you could perhaps set up a regular savings scheme. Some of the investment trust houses do some very cost-effective versions of that and perhaps feed in £100 or £200 a month, see how it goes, build up a spread. I do know someone who's got 17 of these plans.
Wow.
And he has accumulated a very useful nest egg without a massive amount of effort. The effort has to be put in at the start by doing good research, having good sources of information and making some great choices, which isn't always easy, of course.
So where would you look for that, to do that research and get the good information?
Exactly. Well, there are some good free websites. My colleague Nick here has got a good one at the AIC, and they've got their site has improved over the years and has got a lot of information on it. Am I allowed to mention any other names?
Oh, please
do. TrustNet is a good one. There's a couple of specialist newsletters. The main one is Andrew McHattie, the McHattie newsletter. If you go on the web, you can find that.
You have to pay for that one.
It's a fair old annual subscription, but quite honestly, that is money well spent because he knows what he's doing.
Okay, and maybe some other ones. I guess Citywire off the top of your head is another one that perhaps is quite good as well.
Morningstar would be another one.
Of course, yeah, good suggestion, Nick. Is it also worth actually going and seeing an advisor and paying up and getting some good solid advice that's appropriate to you? What do you think, Nick, about that?
Yes, I think if you're at all uncertain about investing, then seeing a financial advisor is a good idea anyway, because seeing a financial advisor isn't just about selecting an investment. Clearly, it's about having a whole financial plan. It's about tax and all those things, which you won't get just as a DIY investor. If you are confident, though, investing on your own, there are thousands and thousands of DIY investors who love investment trusts and who've had very good experiences with them. So there's no reason at all why you shouldn't do that. But if you are unsure, then that's what financial advisors are there for.
Well, we've talked about the hypothetical person in their 30s. Let's talk now about another hypothetical person in their early 60s. She's retired. She's reasonably well off. Should she completely write off investment trusts? Is it too late for her to get involved at this stage in her life, or does it make sense? And what should she be focusing on? John, let's start with you.
Yes, I was wincing at the very suggestion that anyone would ever walk away from participating in this category of investment. I guess later in life, probably the income theme would become more important. You know, it's wrong to get obsessed about dividend yield as a general statement, but when you're over 60, an example you're quoting, and perhaps you're not earning perhaps as much as you were, well, you're going to draw that dividend income in, and that's going to be very, very useful to you in your retirement years. I would also stress, though, that if you can, try and invest in stuff that's still got some potential for capital growth. After all, someone aged 60 nowadays could live to 90 or 100, whatever age it might be. You've still got a long time horizon ahead. So what I'm saying there really is there are some strategies which give you all-out income, which means your potential for capital growth is much more restricted. I'd hesitate to do that unless you really need that income.
OK, I mean, Nick mentioned a couple of sectors, smaller companies and emerging markets, which at least are sometimes seen as higher-risk sectors. You need to invest for the long term. You're taking on a higher risk to get, hopefully, some good growth at the end of it. I think some people at least would say, well, if you're in your 60s, you shouldn't be looking at those high-risk areas. But I guess, John, if someone might live to 90 or 100, they maybe should even think about those parts of the market. Would you agree?
I certainly wouldn't rule it out. Obviously, it depends on what other assets they've got and their income requirement I've already mentioned. What is a priceless asset advantage of trusts that we haven't come to yet is the fact they've got an independent board of directors. You, as a shareholder owning one share, can go along to the annual general meeting. And, of course, if you're retired, semi-retired, you've got the time to do that. You can meet the fund manager, you can meet the board face-to-face, which you cannot do with other types of investment, and you will learn something, and it's a very satisfying experience, and you feel you've joined a club.
Just one more point on the sort of the overall risk side of things. I mean, John mentioned that, you know, it does partly depend on how many other assets you have. Nick, how much money or property should you have before you start investing in property, and particularly in that example of someone in their 60s or maybe even a bit older?
Before you start investing in an investment trust?
Exactly. So you need to have some cash in the building society as sort of your rock-solid base.
Yes. I mean, everyone should have their rainy day cash that they need for emergencies. Whatever that is for them, they need to work it out and they should have that in cash, absolutely. And then really it depends on their financial goals. But there's no sort of minimum amount here. I mean, some of these regular saving plans we talked about, you can start from as little as £20 a month. Or £50 a month, and obviously it goes right up to people who are pretty wealthy and putting large amounts of money in. But I think one point that I wanted to cover in relation to the hypothetical 70-year-old we were talking about is the ability of investment trusts to actually deliver a smoother stream of income. So unlike open-ended funds, investment trusts can actually reserve income. They can put aside 15% of the income.
So when they get a dividend from a company they've invested in, they don't have to pay that all on to the shareholder in one go of the investment trust.
Precisely. They can reserve up to 15% of that income, and they put it in a kind of pot called the revenue reserve, sort of rainy day fund, and they can use that revenue reserve to pay out dividends, to top up dividends in future years when dividends from the market might fall. And so for this reason, we've got investment trusts that have records of up to 50 years of increasing dividends every single year. And the big kind of grandfather of them all is City of London Investment Trust, which has done it for 50 years in a row. So since 1967, it's been paying out increased income every year. And it couldn't have done that without this ability to reserve income that is unique to investment trusts.
I should declare I own a very small number of shares in the City of London Trust. Since you've mentioned it, Nick, I'll just read out some performance figures for that trust. We'll look at the net asset value. So is this the value of the underlying portfolio, not the share price of the trust? Over 1 year, it's gone up 24%. Over 3 years, 27.5%. Over 5 years, 74%. And that's over 5 years. That's 10th out of 23 in the sector. Over 3 years, 7th out of 23 in the sector. And I should say, of course, that's looking at the capital appreciation. It's not really looking at the income, which of course the trust also pays. Let's take a quick break now. We'll come back and we'll look at some of the other peculiarities or distinguishing factors around investment trusts compared to other forms of investment fund.
The Investment Trust Show, brought to you by Henderson Global Investors, managing investment trusts since 1934.
Welcome back to the show. This afternoon, we are discussing how to pick an investment trust. My guests today are Nick Britton, head of training, at the Association of Investment Companies, otherwise known as the AIC, and John Newlands, who is the head of investment companies research at Brewin Dolphin. My name is Ed Bauscher. Now, let's look at the issue of what investment trusts invest in. We know that many of them buy shares in listed companies, but do they sometimes invest in other assets as well? John, can you start us off with that?
Yes, you know, it's important to distinguish between what we used to call generalist funds, which might have a very large portfolio spread across the globe, highly diversified, good sleep at night stuff, and trusts that invest in very specific areas. There's one called Geiger Counter, for instance, that invests in depleted uranium. You've got gold funds, as Nick touched upon earlier. You've got smaller companies, whether UK smaller companies, emerging markets, Latin America. So there's a big range out there.
Okay, so let's say we have listeners who now want to think about picking an investment trust. We've told them they don't just invest in the stock market. We've told them about risk and what's appropriate given your stage in life. And we know we can get information from websites such as TrustNet. But what should they look for on those sites? Should they just be looking at the past performance of the trust? Should they be looking at what the manager says he wants to do? Or are there other things they should look at as well? Nick, kick us off with that.
Well, I suppose the place to start is, what are you trying to achieve from this investment? Are you looking for an income that's going to grow? Are you looking for a high income? Are you just more interested in the growth? And once you have an idea of that, then you can zone in on a particular sector. Now, we organise our investment trust into sectors. So, for example, we have the UK equity income sector, and we have the Property Direct UK sector and the Asia Pacific sector. So knowing what sector you're looking in will narrow the choice down enormously, and you'll then be left with a choice probably between 5 and 20 investment trusts that you can rank by performance, by yield, by expense ratios. That's how much you pay as an investor to the fund manager, and other things. And then you can then begin to make your choice and build up a picture.
But are the past performance figures of any use? I often read that past performance figures don't really correlate with future performance.
Well, the one thing everyone says, and we have to say, is what you've just said, that past performance is no guarantee of future returns. But on the other hand, everybody is always interested in past performance. And I think when you look at it, clearly you have to think about, how does it compare with the sector? How does it compare with the benchmark? The benchmark, so for example, the FTSE All Share, if it's a UK equity fund, how does it compare with the wider market? And then you've got to think, you know, how has the fund manager achieved those returns? Are they investing in more risky areas of the market, like smaller companies? You have to put the performance in a bit of a context. It's a lot more complicated than just going after the fund that's delivered the best performance over the past year or 5 years or even 10 years.
And you mentioned looking at the total expense ratio, looking at the costs you have to pay to the management company. Do you find that the more expensive funds charging more money, do they tend to perform better? Is there any correlation there, John?
Well, my short answer to that is no, not necessarily. I'd perhaps give you a specific example. The biggest trust of them all now is a fund called Scottish Mortgage. It's just entered the FTSE 100. It's £5 billion in size, having come from much more modest beginnings. And its base fee is basically 0.3% of total assets per annum. So that is a very large, liquid, reputable, long-lived trust with a good record. And it's on this incredibly low fee. So not necessarily is the short answer to your question.
I take your point. 0.3% is very low for an investment trust and doesn't sound like very much money each year. Mm. But of course, there are even cheaper investment vehicles, the passive funds we hear so often about. The managers of the Scottish Mortgage Trust, they are picking their investments. You could just put money into, say, a FTSE 100 passive fund that just buys all the funds in that index, and then your charges could be 0.1% a year or even lower. So, Nick, why should people continue to look at perhaps the slightly old-fashioned investment trusts when the modern trendy things are the passive funds, the ETFs that have lower charges?
Well, we don't think we're old-fashioned. I mean, we have been around since 1868, that's right, but our sector has changed enormously with the times. And just to give you an example, over the last 10 years, we've been raising money in infrastructure, property, all sorts of specialist debt, all sorts of new and exciting sectors. But to answer your point about active versus passive, this is clearly not the place to have a big active versus passive debate. And also, I suspect John and I would take the same side anyway.
Yep.
But I think what we can say is, if you believe in active management, if you think that it is possible to pick active managers who do outperform the market, then investment trust is where you should go. Because an investment trust gives the fund manager the maximum flexibility and freedom to actually outperform. Because it doesn't have to create and cancel shares when investors buy and sell, the manager gets freedom to time their buy and sell decisions as they want. And that's the great thing about this structure for the fund manager. If you talk to fund managers who manage both, they generally prefer the investment trust structure.
John?
I'd like to give an analogy, if I might, Ed, which represents my views on the subject. Let's look at football. Let's talk about the Premiership. You might say that the average football team in the Premiership League finishes halfway up the table. Is that a reason for not supporting football? No. You're trying to pick the team that is top of the league. You might pick the team that's the bottom of the league. It's the same with investment. With these passive funds, you'll finish somewhere in the middle, perhaps. What our job is to pick the funds that are going to outperform and do well. Scottish Mortgage is a classic case. There are several others. So I'm no fan of passive investment, although I recognise it has its place in the world.
Let's talk a bit more about risk. I think we can all agree that stock markets can be risky. They go up and down. But history suggests over the long term, they do tend to do pretty well, but no guarantee that will continue. But if we have listeners who are thinking of investing in investment trusts for the first time right now, the stock market is at record highs. Is it not the case that now is a dumb time to get involved, Nick?
Well, again, it depends how you're investing and what your goals are. So if you're investing regularly, you know, £50 a month or whatever, then over time, you will average out the price you pay to get into the market, and it won't matter so much your entry point. But I suspect neither of us is going to be bold enough to forecast the future direction of markets in the short term. What we do know is that over the long term, they equity markets tend to outperform other asset classes.
Tend is the crucial word. But I accept what you're saying. Finally, we should talk about discounts, often used word in the investment trust sector. And it's basically the point that investment trusts, unlike other funds, you have a share price of the trust, you have the underlying value of the trust, the assets that it owns, and they don't always move in sync. So sometimes you might get a fund where the share price is 10% below the underlying value of the portfolio, then you have a 10% discount. You might have a 5% premium where the share price is higher than the underlying net asset value. John, should our listeners, when they're doing their research on the AIC website, on TrustNet, should they be focusing on discounts? And how important is it? And what should they look for?
Absolutely right, Ed. It's often the first parameter that people quote when they're talking about investment trusts. That trust on a wide discount, it must be cheap. This is not necessarily true. There are some trusts that perhaps, you know, were on a 20% discount 5 years ago. They're still on a 20% discount today. There are people who play the discount and make money from it, but I frankly wouldn't recommend it for those who are trying to salt away a nest egg over many decades. It's not the first thing to look at.
But Nick, if I saw a trust with a premium, at least would that be a case where you might think, well, I'll hold off. Fine, it doesn't really matter whether it's a 5% discount or a 10% discount, but a 2% premium, isn't that a fairly obvious sign that it's too expensive?
It can be, yes. You have to weigh it up, don't you? And if there is a trust on a 2% premium and a very similar trust that you also like on a 10% discount, then I think you can start to use the discount as a factor in the decision. But I absolutely agree with John. It should not be the first thing you look at. It should not be the driver of the decision.
And, of course, there's gearing as well. Investment trusts can, if they wish, to borrow money to invest, which hopefully can boost performance if things go well. And, of course, it can damage performance if things go badly. Is that something, Nick, that investors should look at closely as well? And can they find that gearing data on your website along with the discounts or premiums?
Yes, they can. They can find not only how geared an investment trust is at the moment, which might be, say, 7% gearing. That's the average for all investment trusts. But they can also find something called the gearing range. And that is very useful because what that is it might be, for example, 0 to 25. That shows you that in normal conditions, that trust will stay within a 0 to 25% range of gearing. And it's up to you to decide, is that an amount of gearing, an amount of risk that you're comfortable with or not?
John, do you focus on gearing a lot? Is there a level where you might think, no, that's too much?
Following on from what Nick's just said, you can find a trust if you're not comfortable with gearing, you can find trusts that don't use it at all. Some of them are very good. Speaking personally, I'm a believer in long-term gearing, especially at the moment when trusts can go out and borrow at 3% per annum. History suggests to me that the long-term annualised returns are going to be more than that, and that borrowing to invest more is going to reward you over the long term. But it can be slightly more painful over the shorter term.
Well, we're almost at the end of today's show. I'll just give some performance figures for the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust we mentioned earlier. So this is a big generalist trust with about £5 billion market cap. Over the last year, its net asset value, the underlying value of the portfolio, has gone up 34%. Fourth out of 24 in the sector. Over 3 years, up 70.3%, second out of 24 in the sector. And over 5 years, 138%, second out of 24 in the sector. My thanks to our two excellent guests today, Nick Britton, head of training at the AIC, and also John Newlands, head of investment companies research at Brewin Dolphin. John's down from Newcastle today. Both pleasure to have you on the show. You've both been on the show before. I do hope we'll see you again on the Investment Trust Show at Share Radio. And we will have another show here on Share Radio at the same time next week.
The Investment Trust Show, brought to you by Henderson Global Investors, managing investment trusts since 1934.
At Henderson Global Investors, we believe in helping people to make informed investment decisions by sharing our knowledge. We are a proud sponsor of the Investment Trust Show on Share Radio, and we currently manage a range of 13 investment trusts in a wide range of sectors, geographies, and markets across the globe. Visit us at hendersoninvestmenttrusts.com. Henderson Global Investors is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority to provide investment products and services.